Today's interview is with Fiona Kalacki. Fiona reached out to me after hearing me on Tracy Harris's Mums with Hustle podcast. She started listening to Carlosophies and she reached out to ask if I was open to having her on as a guest. And of course, I'm always open to have people on with a guest, particularly when they have an incredible story and such a generous spirit. Fiona reached out and basically gave me the kick up the bum I needed. She told me I should be writing, or I could be writing, and then gave me some connections to get started, which was so generous of her. Most people hold their cards really close to their chest, but she was just like, your voice needs to be out there, and here's some people you can contact to make that happen. And that's quite rare in this world, and something that I really admire about Fiona. Something else I really admire about her is her willingness just to ask, you know, just to throw her hat in the ring. And she doesn't think about it so much. You know, I'm always thinking, oh, you know, I don't know, who would I contact? I want to write, but who would I contact? And she just literally goes to the doctors when she's sitting in the surgery, flips through a magazine, looks for the editor, boom, there's the person she contacts. And she just reaches out to them. Doesn't take it personally if they don't get back. She just does it. And here we are a lot of the time really overthinking things, really overthinking things. So this is a really great conversation. I think you're really going to dig it. And I hope it gives you a kick up the bum and just reach out, throw your hat in the ring. All right, on with the show. This is Fiona Kalacki. Welcome to Carlosophies, Stories Behind Success. I'm Carly Nimmo. It's so easy to fall into comparisonitis as an entrepreneur, and it can be paralyzing. In my own journey, I've come to understand that regardless of your level of success, fame, or fortune, we're all suffering from the same stories of fear, struggle, and failure. So let's talk about it.
I guess my career started when I finished uni. I didn't really know what I wanted to do, so I'd done an arts degree, as you do, and all my friends were getting jobs as lawyers or accountants or, you know, real jobs, I guess. And so I thought, what am I going to do? I'll just go to London, because I was born over there, so I had a passport, and I thought, I'm going to get a one-way ticket to London. So I did, much to my parents' dismay. I kind of told them, like 2 weeks out, that I was going to London and on a one-way ticket. Didn't know a soul in London. I found this girl on the internet to live with. She was hilarious. And, yeah, went to London, got an internship at Dazed and Confused magazine, got an internship at New Woman magazine, where I was just doing the shit-kicking. I was getting coffees. I was emptying the bins. And I needed a job to, like, pay the rent. So I got a job at an ad agency. So I was the PA to the director. And we did like really horrible council notices, like bills and things. And then they didn't have anyone to proofread. So they'd say, oh, Fiona, can you do the proofreading? And it was all like Punjabi and Turkish and languages I didn't understand. But I thought, okay, whatevs. And I did that for a while. And I just loved being away from Melbourne and people watching and just seeing, like, meeting people from different cultures. Yeah. And so I didn't really do much writing, even though I'd kind of gone there with the plan that I'd get into a magazine, but did a little bit in ad agency. And then about, I'd say 10 months into that trip, my best friend in Australia died in a car accident. Mm. So that kind of put things into perspective. I didn't come home right away because I kind of thought, I don't want her funeral to be like the last memory I have of her. So I stayed on for a couple of months, and then another friend from ours from high school died. And I kind of thought, like, what's happening? Like, we're only 21. So I got on a plane and went home back to Australia. And I got a job. I got two jobs. I was the door bitch at a really bad bar in Collingwood, which was really fun because I got free drinks and stuff. And then I also got a job at the Age call centre. So this is the Age newspaper in Australia. And it was back before the internet was around, but people were not, you know, it was still people put, you know, if I want to sell a car, I put the car ad into the Age. And so I was working in the Age, and my main job there was to check death notices, so to check that people had actually died. I know, well, actually someone had put in a death notice in the Age for a politician who wasn't dead, and he had sued the Age. Ah. So they had a team of us that worked basically calling like coroners and calling funeral homes and just checking that, you know, this death notice has come in, can we publish it, are they really dead? So I did that for a while, and my mum was kind of at me saying, you know, we busted our ass to get you to a private school and you went to uni, like, are you going to work at a call centre for the rest of your life? So I thought, okay, I'll just go back to uni to like quiet my mother. So I went back and studied journalism, which is kind of what I'd wanted to do in London, but didn't have any qualifications or experience. So I was studying journalism and I was working at the Age call centre during uni. And I also started at that time working at a clothing factory. So my best friend who died in London, her parents owned a clothing factory in Melbourne. So I was learning how to cut patterns and things like that. And all around this time, Yen magazine came out. And I contacted the editor and I was like, this is such a cool magazine. I really love it. And she was like, you know, your letter to the editor is quite well written. Would you like to write for us?
Wow. That's totally random.
So random. And I was just so excited. But I remember calling my brother and being like, what should I do? And he was like, just say yes. And I was like, oh, okay. And I guess that's a theme in the whole of my life. I'm always looking to other people to sort of validate what I think I should do. And so I sort of thought, shit, what am I going to write about? And in the clothing factory, all of these old women from Italy had been telling me, like, you know, Australia used to have a booming clothing industry and now everything's gone offshore. So I thought, I'll write about that because at least I've got someone to interview. So I wrote about that. And because it was about fashion, that was the only piece of work I had to then send to other editors. So I kind of thought it's easier then to send a fashion article to other fashion magazines. So at the time there was, well, there still is, a free street press called Fashion Journal. I don't know if you've ever seen it. So it's been going for about probably 30 years now. It's by the same people that do Beat magazine. And
oh, yeah, I'm familiar with Beat, yeah. I spent most of my late teens and early 20s with my head in Beat. What's the gig on this weekend?
It was so popular. It's like social media back
totally
in the 90s.
It was.
So I was still at uni and I was finishing up my degree and I kind of needed a job. So I contacted Fashion Journal with my one published piece. And Joe Barry, who was the editor there, said, hey, come on, we need an intern. Why don't you come and work for us? So I worked for them. And then a few months in, she was like, I'm sick of this job. I'm going to quit tomorrow. And they're probably going to ask you to be the editor. And I was like, oh, shit. So I was like, okay. And she's like, and you should say yes. And I was like, okay, I'll say yes. So that's exactly what happened. And they offered me like $27,000. And I was like, woohoo. So I worked there as the editor for the next 3.5 years. So I looked after Fashion Journal, Stu, which was like an arts magazine. And then we pitched and won David Jones Precinct magazine. So at the time, David Jones, which is one of the biggest retailers in Australia, was really trying to change their demographic and go from like old rich ladies into like upwardly mobile. And it was before social media. So they needed this cool magazine. So that was my job and loved it. And, you know, got all this free stuff and it was just a really fun time. Everyone in the office, it was our first job and we're all just so excited and enthusiastic. But I kind of realized I didn't know the editorial markups. I didn't know how to be an editor. So again, I thought I'll go back to uni and study editing and publishing. And the course advisor for that at RMIT, he was like, yep, you can get accepted, but I'm not taking you as a magazine editor. You'll have to be a book editor because we focus predominantly on book publishing. So I was like, all right, better get a job in that. And I had two months to find a job. And I ended up working at Pearson, which is like one of the largest publishers in the world. They own Penguin and lots of other things. And I was still writing. So all the time that I'd been, since I wrote for Yen, I'd literally, in 2002, I'd literally just been writing for anyone and everyone. If I was in the doctors and picked up a magazine, I'd just flip to the front, look at who the editor was, contact them and start writing.
That is so cool. Oh, my God. I just need to take a leaf out of your book. I'm so glad we're having this chat today.
Oh, God, you just need to do it. So many people would say to me, like, how did you write for so many publications? And I'm like, I just contacted them. So I'd been writing for lots and that included some places overseas like Cool Hunting in New York and Soma, which is an amazing magazine in San Francisco. And so I got to book publishing and I liked it, but it was pretty dry. You were working, magazines were kind of fast-paced and book publishing was great, but it was 9 months. It's roughly a nine-month project for a book. And I was working on education books and I was working with a lot of like older teachers who were just sort of wanting to put me in my place quite often. But it was okay, and the team were lovely. But I kind of wanted to keep pursuing the writing. So I was doing a lot of writing. So I was kind of getting up at 5 a.m. doing writing and going to work and then going to uni. And so a few months into this, one of my writers from Fashion Journal was now working at The Age, and he said they're looking for a new social reporter for the back page of the Sunday Age. Would you be interested? And so I said, yeah, I don't know what I have to do. And he's like, you have to audition this week. And by audition, you had to go to like a huge event. So it was the Melbourne International Film Festival. And you weren't allowed to tell anyone that you were there from The Age, but you just had to go and interview people and then write 500 words and submit it that night. And so I went along freaking out because I'm quite an introvert. And
that would just, that's like my worst nightmare, having to go up to people, not with the badge of, oh, I'm from blah, 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 blah. Can I talk to you? Like, oh my God, just approaching people. Oh,
totally. And just being like, hi. I can't hide behind anything. And I remember, like, we watched, you know, whatever the film was, and then it was, like, the drinks and, you know, networking part. And I looked around and I saw some people from, like, Neighbours and some other places, and I just freaked out. And I went to the toilet and I called my husband. I was like, I'm not doing this. I cannot talk to anyone. It's not even worth it. Like, and he was like, come on, it's a column, a weekly column in The Age. I was like, okay. So then I went outside and there was this amazing Indigenous actress there just standing near there, and she just gave me a smile, and I thought, this is it. This is my chance. It's now or never. So ended up getting an amazing story about Indigenous actors in the Australian film scene, submitted it, and then got the job.
Wow.
So I was, yeah,
so
it was crazy. It was really cool, but it was just insane. So I was like, yeah, getting up, doing freelance writing, going to work, going to uni between 4:30 and 8, and then the photographer from The Age was picking me up to go to events till like 10 o'clock and then going home and doing it the next day. So it's just not sustainable. So I said to my husband, like, I get $600 a week from this column. That's enough to pay our rent, or like my part of the rent. What if I just went out on my own? And he was like, why don't you do it? Yeah, just went to talk to my boss at the book publisher, and she's like, would you be interested in freelancing for us? And I was like, yeah. So quit like the 15th of December. On the 16th, had a contract with Pearson for a year-long proofreading editing. And then a lot of friends had just started opening, like doing their own websites and needing branded content. So I just did that, and it was awesome. I loved it. And I was interviewing lots of people, and I was doing really well, and then decided that we wanted to go back to London because I sort of felt that my friend dying had, well, not her dying, had cut my trip short, but that whole thing had cut my trip short. So went back to London, and that was really a bit of a silly decision because we went from winter in Australia to winter in London and right into the global financial crisis. And I'd come from sort of not like, oh, I'm being a big fish at all, but I had, you know, the column in the paper. I was going to every event. I was getting all this free shit. I was, you know, people would send champagne to me, like PR girls, and everything was really cushy.
Yeah,
and then I went,
you were established, and then
yeah.
Yeah, it's like going from, well, this is so not like, but you know when you're in grade 6 and you think you're the shit and you're walking around, and then you go to year 7 and it's like, fuck, I'm nobody.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah, so I went into London and got a massively rude awakening that no one knew what The Age was. They thought it was some country hick paper. People were coming from like the New Yorker, the Times in London. I just couldn't compete. I wasn't on that level. And so it took me a good few months to find a job, and I got quite down on myself, and I found that was really because I'd kind of built it up that I was going to take over London somehow, and so that was hard. But I eventually got a job at Open University, so looking after the MBA program and looking at how you can engage people online, particularly people that are doing an MBA, you know, when they're working full-time as well. So that was good. Then moved on to Amazon, so working in kitchen and home for Amazon, looking at all of their marketing and content, looking at, you know, buyer behavior, looking at, you know, if people have a new baby, they're more likely to buy a vacuum cleaner because they start freaking out about germs.
That is so, so true. Oh, my God. I bought a vacuum cleaner when I was pregnant. That is so weird.
So you start looking at, like, behavior. So if someone buys kitchen food, they're more likely that they're going to buy something to clean up cat hair. If someone buys nappies, vacuum cleaner. Someone buys Jamie Oliver cookbooks, they're more interested in baking. Like, so you started sort of capturing people's behaviour. Worked there for a while, which was really full on, but an awesome job. And just the level of intelligence of the people that I worked with was just incredible and I loved it. And then, yeah, decided we wanted to have a baby, and Amazon at the time was in Slough, which I don't know, have you seen The Office? You know, the show The Office with
I like the show. Yeah.
So that's set in Slough. It's like the shittiest part of the UK. So Amazon was out there because it was really cheap rent. So it was a bit of a trek each day. So we thought, when I get pregnant, I'm not going to be able to do like a 3-hour round trip to work. And so I looked for a part-time job, and I got a job at Audible, the audio books company, which is also owned by Amazon. So it was kind of an easy shift. And then found out I was pregnant 2 weeks after getting to Audible. And I was freaking out about like maternity cover and all of that, trying to like secretly talk to HR about what I was eligible for. Yeah, I was pregnant and really decided that London's a really hard place to be if you don't have support. And I had a crash one cesarean. The breastfeeding went wrong after a few weeks. I had to go back to hospital. So it was all a bit full on. And I also, because everything in my life I'd been able to control, I'd kind of like, if I want this job, I can get it. You know, you can't control a baby.
Oh, no.
So that first 2 months, I literally had Excel spreadsheets. When I think of it now, I just feel disgusted. But I had Excel spreadsheets with like how much sleep and when's he doing a poo and just so much stupid stuff. You put so much pressure on yourself as a first-time mum. So I decided after a while that we'd come back to Australia, that we'd have support around us. And I'm from England and I didn't have any cousins growing up. So we really wanted my son to have that, or I wanted him to have that experience that I didn't have. So I came back to Australia, worked a digital agency, looking after like Vic Health and Porsche and strategies for digital engagement, and really wanted to go out on my own. And then I got this job offer, or this job interview offer, for this accessories company, pretty big accessories company. And I just said to my husband, I'm just going for the interview. I'm not going to take this job. Like, I don't like this company. I've never bought their stuff. It's not me, but I just want to see where I sit in comparison to the industry. Went and, of course, took the job. Like, they offered me a lot of money and I was like, okay, the security is easier than having to set myself up. And so I took this job, much against, you know, my instinct. And it was full on. It was brand content manager. It was trying to really take a very divided company. So like the PR team didn't talk to the design team didn't talk to digital, none of them talked to the content team, and try and make them, you know, a well-oiled machine and to talk to each other and have a consistent message. So I was there for a while. I was working around the clock, like going to work at 5:30, working weekends. And it got to the November, like Cup Day weekend, and I was doing all of this work. We'd gone to my sister's farm for like the weekend, me and my husband and my son. And I was in the house doing all this work and looking out the window, and everyone was having a, you know, great time with the barbecue and the sun was shining. And I just thought, what am I doing? I'm giving everything to this job and nothing to my family and nothing to myself. I'm not having fun. And I just sent this huge like campaign kind of document to my boss at the time, and she wrote back just this barrage of like assault. That was her sort of way of managing people.
Mm-hmm. Which is why the company was so probably so divided, you know.
And so, I wrote this thing and then she wrote back, and then I just wrote like a one-line response, and she wrote, wow, brevity. And I said, I was like, I'm sorry, it's a public holiday. Like, I'm not writing anything else. I'm not doing any other work on this. And I kind of decided at the end of the holiday, that's it, I'm going to quit by Christmas. But Christmas came around and they offered me a head of marketing role, and I thought, no, I'm not going to take it. And I texted my husband and he said, you know, do not do this. Like, please do not do this. And I just, I don't know, like I sort of got caught up with like the title and the money. And at the time I was working full time, my husband was working part time to look after our son. And we were saving for a house. And so I kind of got caught up with all this pressure and thinking that the only way to relieve that was to say yes to this job. And I just kind of kept putting it off. I should have known that, because I just kept trying to say to HR, oh, I need a bit more time. I even asked for more money, thinking that they would say no and then they could easily get out. And they said yes. And then I remember they said, you've got 48 hours to give us a decision. And I got in, like, that day when they said it, I, like, got in my car at lunchtime and, like, drove to a nearby street and called my sister. And I was like, what am I to do? And she's like, just don't say yes. Just quit. Like, you'll be fine. And she was like, I'll give you $5,000 to just you know, tide you over, but you'll be okay. And so I thought, okay, what should I do? What should I do? Went back with all of the intention to say no to it, but ended up saying yes. They were like, we're going to give you this much extra. And so I said yes, and I just worked insane hours for the next 6 months. I was just not a nice person. I'm sure I was a nice person at work, and I'm sure, I mean, I know I was a nice person at work, and I was a nice person to my friends, but at home I was not a nice person. Mm-hmm. My husband put up with a lot of shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'd wake up angry, I'd wake up stressed. I'd get text messages from my managing director at like 11 o'clock at night asking me to jump online and check something, which I thought was totally okay. I don't know what bubble I was in, but I totally thought that was fine. And so did that for, 6 months. And my health had gone to the back burner. Everything had just gone, everything was just put behind this job. And then a friend asked me to go to a goal setting workshop with her, and I thought, oh, this is, you know, fluff, but whatevs, I'll go, it's free champagne. And we went, and it completely changed my life. The lady running it was amazing, and she did this vision exercise, which I now run in all of my workshops, which is, you know, write your diary entry a year from mm-hmm. now. And I wrote it, and we got to the end of the exercise, and she said, how does everyone feel? And I just was like, I want this life. I want to be here. And she was like, well, what's stopping you? And for the first time, none of these excuses came up. It was just, what is stopping me? And it just happened that we were going on a family holiday to Bali like a few days later. So I spent Bali just relaxing, but also putting together a whole business plan of what I would do, how I would get out
just
of there.
Just casually putting together.
A notebook, and I scribbled down, and one of the best things I've ever done, which I tell people to do now, is I scribbled down every person that had ever said something to me like, I'd love to talk to you about my business, or you're a really good writer, maybe you could write something for my website, or anyone that had ever commented. And I also wrote down every company that I'd ever thought was doing well, like that they had a good culture. Yeah, I wrote down, it was 62 names at the end of the list. And I thought, I'm just going to work through the one by one, go get coffee, see if they can give me some work. And I did that, and I gave myself 6 months left at this job, and 6 months to build up my business to the point where I could quit and not leave my family, you know, financially.
Destitute. Medic.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, my husband was working and he had good money, but I just didn't want to be like selfish and kind of feel like, oh, okay, it's okay, I'm going to go earn nothing. Yeah, and I did that and managed to get some amazing people behind me that said, I would love to hire you 2 days a week. I'd love to hire you 1 day a week. And I knew that I had enough money, got the contracts from them, and then quit. And it was the best thing ever. I just felt like a completely different person. And that was 2015. And I've been, working as a consultant for small businesses and some large businesses like Etsy, but mainly small creative businesses and solo like micro businesses on their, well, it started as marketing and content, but more and more people were sort of saying, oh, I need you to like look at my whole business. And it's very hard to get a marketing strategy if there's no business strategy, if the business doesn't have goals attached to it. So I started doing more on goals and looking at people's whys, and people were sort of saying, oh, you're like my business coach. And I really hated that term. I hated coach, life coach, business coach, any of it. And I just thought, oh, no, I'm not that person. But more and more people just kept saying it, and I thought, that's what it's called. So just get over yourself, Fiona. And so, started my daily business coach, and I work with, lots of lovely people. So that's my story.
That's cool. So a few things came up while you were doing, I made some notes, because there were so many similarities between your story and mine, but different. Like when you were talking about, the cup day weekend and you kind of just being separate from what was going on because of work and not having that separation. And I had a moment that I've spoken about a few times recently with friends where their businesses have been going great guns and they're doing really well financially, but then they're looking around going, oh shit, why am I still unhappy? I'm there, mm-hmm. I'm there and they're working like a bloody workhorse. You know, they've built their business up to the point where they're now you know, they can't remove themselves because it's a personal brand and it's just the way yeah. they've kind of built this business. And now they're realizing it's not serving them. And when I was running Killer Copy, I still am, but, you know, for those first few years, I had no boundaries. So people would contact me at night and I'd email and I'd be up at 11:30 recording a voiceover for someone who needed it the next day. And it just got, the boundaries got more and more like a noose around my neck. It just felt like I was kind of hanging there, you know. It was just horrible. And the final straw for me was my nana died in 2009, and at the wake I was in the spare room working, and I was just thinking, what the fuck am I doing? Something has to change. So then put in boundaries, introduced rush fees, you know, did a whole bunch of stuff to remove myself more from the business, and then gave me a lot more freedom, which then caused me to go down the rabbit hole of starting 10 million other different businesses. Freedom can be a dangerous thing.
It sounds really cliche, but it is that whole, you know, people will do what you let them do. And yeah, putting up boundaries. And it's something now with my clients, like I just say, I don't work Fridays. Like I have that with my son. And, you know, I have to be finished by 3 o'clock. And there's been some things that have come up where I've sort of faltered for a minute and thought, oh, maybe I could put him in childcare. Maybe I could do this. And then I'm like, no. Because it is a slippery slope.
It is a slippery slope. And once you've bent over, oh, that sounds horrible. But you know, but then it's always those people that you bend over for who then don't respect your boundaries going yeah. forward, because they know they're like, I don't know, like people are like children. They're constantly testing your boundaries. It's not their fault. They're not trying to manipulate you. They don't yeah. even know that you're actually bending over a lot of the time. You're the one bending over, you know, they're just doing their thing. Yeah, it's tricky. Boundaries are really tricky, particularly when you try to enforce them post, you yes, know.
And they're like, but you just this one time, just yeah. this one time. Yeah, it's really hard.
And there was another thing that kind of came up for me, which is another parallel, was when you had said about the job and taking the job. And mm-hmm. and every part of you was saying no, and everyone around you was saying no, but you ended up saying yes. I had a similar thing with Radcasters, actually, where – and I was just being a total bitch to Mikko, so stressed. It wasn't working. What was I doing wrong? I'd talk to him about it and he would say, you don't have to do it. And I'd just mm-hmm. be like, fuck you. You don't understand. Blah, 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 blah. You know, I've got to make this work, kind of thing. And he was just basically saying, this isn't serving you, let it go. And all, like, it would just be like this visceral reaction in me, which was like, fuck you.
Yeah. You know? Oh, that was like that. You were exactly, it's like you're mirroring exactly what happened. Like yeah. I'd get in the car and be like, I'm late, I'm late, I'm late, and like speed off through our street. And then I'd be late, but I'm not, like, I'm late to get to the work, to get to the office to be the first person there. Like, that's not late. Like, yeah, you're just putting priorities on things that don't deserve it.
Yeah. And I think, like, you know, when you show up in, because then when you show up at a workplace or on a call or whatever, and you have to put that mask on because all of, you know, your personal life feels like shit, but there's this mask that has to go on in the workplace, then the personal life stuff gets worse and worse, doesn't it? It's like the level of the mask that you have to put on to show up at the workplace is undone and hideously unraveled in your personal life.
Yeah, and then you're coming home and you've got zero energy, because it takes energy to put that front on, and then all you want to do is, or I wanted to do, was like crack open a bottle of wine and not have to talk to anyone, like, which was an awful way to be when you've got a toddler and a loving husband there, and you've all just come back from London as well. So but it's hard because I see so many people still in that mindset, still in that work bubble, that work is everything, checking their phone when we're at dinner. And you just want to shake them, but I think it's everyone's individual journey, because I had plenty of people shaking me and I didn't get out of it.
Absolutely. I think, I said this to my assistant the other day, you just hear what you're ready to hear. People can say something to you time and time again, and it can be incredibly frustrating for you as the person who's trying to communicate something in the best interests of somebody else, and they can't hear you. And then one day they go, it just lands, and they go, oh, so-and-so told me blah, 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 blah. And I was just like, oh, my God, yes. And then you're like, I've told you that 3 million fucking times and you never heard it.
That's totally my husband saying that. I'll like read a new book and I'm like, oh, my goodness, did you ever think of it this way? And he's like, have we not been discussing that for the last few years? I'm like, yes. Okay. Didn't hear.
I just wasn't
hearing. Yeah, you hear it when you're ready.
Yeah, exactly. You totally do. So during this whole period of, all the, because it sounds like you started out really much, very much a writer and kind of moved more into the marketing strategy space.
Yeah, marketing strategy. Yep.
And so during this whole time, has your real love been writing?
Yeah. I mean, I love helping people, as like cliche and wanky as that sounds, especially being a business coach, but I really do love helping people. So I get excited doing the workshops. But I've always written. So I've probably written for like 45 or 50 titles. And while I was at the accessories company, I stopped writing so much, but it's been something I've always done on the side, and it's something I will always do. And it's something I've turned back to a little bit more now. Like, I'm doing more even marketing articles. I write a business quote, like a business column each month for the Design Files. It's something that I love, and I have I don't want to sound like a wanker, but I have a natural gift for. Like, it's not something I stress about because I know how to do it, and I've done it, and I've proven that to myself. So, yeah, it's something I'll always do. And if I could just, win Tats Lotto and never have to work again and just sit in my log cabin and be a writer, that would be pretty nice.
Do you have plans? Have you, like, you've written for magazines and have worked in publishing. Have you got plans to write your own?
As in my own book?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do have plans. I have a book I started in London that's been sitting there at 60,000 words at the moment. So plan to revisit it at some point. And I'd like to write like a business how-to book, just sort of collating a lot of ideas for people that are starting out and they don't have much support. But I ghost wrote. So in that time that I was freelancing when I'd finished with the book publishing company, I did a lot of ghost writing. So I'd do either private ghost writing, so going to families and interviewing like the grandmother about her life so that the family could keep that book. Or I ghost wrote for some really Z-list celebrities on their autobiographies. So I did that. So yeah, definitely to answer your question, I'd love to have a book one day.
Time to kick up your feet and relax. It's On the Couch.
Biggest fear?
My biggest fear is usual. Well, it's kind of death, which sounds pretty morbid, but it was always the fear that my parents would die, even though I knew that would happen. And my mum recently died very suddenly. She was fine, and then 45 minutes later she was gone about 4 months ago. So I guess I've realised one of those fears, and you realise that somehow you still wake up and the day still goes on. So I feel like, and now I kind of, since having my son, I've always, feared that my son would die, and I hope to God that never happens.
Oh, me too. That's my biggest fear too.
Yeah.
I just can't even think about it. It makes me.
I can't think about that. And I guess my other fear would be, for some reason, stopping what I'm doing now and going back to a corporate job just for the money. But I just don't think that will happen. Like, we've bought a house and the mortgage isn't that much each month. And I don't have expensive taste, and neither does my husband. So we don't have credit cards. We don't buy fancy things. So I can't really see that happening.
Yeah. But, the funny thing is, and something that I definitely realized in the last 6 months, is that we have these huge fears about, going back and finding a job, or, a parent dying, or whatever the fears are. And then when they are realized, you do realize that, well, life goes on.
It's like that, I don't know who said it, Robert Frost or one of the poets said, the greatest thing I've ever learned in life can be summed up in three words: it goes on. And it's totally true. No matter what horrible thing happens to you, you have a decision. Either you kill yourself or you keep going. And for most of us, you keep going and you become stronger. All the cliches, they all rise to the surface when it happens, but you do become stronger out of it.
Totally. What do you struggle with at the moment?
Defining myself by what I do. I think that's something I've always struggled with. I've always been, hi, I'm Fiona, or I'm head of marketing, or I'm a digital strategist, or I'm, you know, XYZ. I think I haven't necessarily put as much effort into like looking at how else I define myself, because for so long that's been what I do, or here's Fiona, she's a writer, or it's always what I've done as a career that has defined who I am. So I really struggle with that. Like I struggle to think, I don't know how I'd introduce myself if you took away everything that I do for a living, like what else do I do kind of thing.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's like I don't even know if it's just a cultural thing or if it's that maybe people won't find us interesting unless we have the labels attached to it or what it is. But I've thought about that a lot lately because it's come up a lot with the interviews where people have reached a crisis when they've realized that they have somehow become the labels that they've put on themselves, and who are we really without them?
Totally. Because you're like with mum passing away, and we had a very close aunt to us pass away last year as well. And again, these cliches, but you go to the funeral and the eulogy is not a CV. It's a how they touch people and what they did with their life and where they traveled and what they loved. And it's never, I mean, they might touch on what they did as a profession, but it's only in showing.
It's like, they worked in a factory making cups or, you know, like it's, yeah absolutely. But it's about the things like every time you went over to her house, there were mint slices on the table and a cup of tea and she was a feeder, or you know what I mean?
Like, or the phrases that she used or the movies, or she loved golf, or you know, things like that. It's not about what her occupation was or wasn't. But I think it is a real cultural thing, because I have a lot of friends who are stay-at-home mums, and they, on the flip side, feel like they're not doing anything. They're like, oh, well, who am I? I'm doing nothing. I've got no job. I'm like, you've got the greatest job of all. You have to look after two little people.
Yeah. I know, it's interesting though, because, yeah, I had a girlfriend who was a stay-at-home mum, and she really struggled, because we do lead with that, right? It's like, hi, I'm Carly, I'm a whatever, entrepreneur, voiceover artist, writer, speaker, blah, blah, blah. You know, like there's a lot, right? And that's how it's like, hi, how are you going? Nice to meet you. What do you do?
Yeah. And you really got to stop yourself. Like I've tried to not ask people what they do. Like ask them, you know, where's your accent from? Or it's a cute top, or not if that's a cute top, that's not something. But, you know, like some other thing. But it is hard. It's really hard. So that's definitely what I struggle with.
Yeah. I might have to make a list of random questions to ask people that aren't about what they do. I do try to avoid it too, but sometimes I'm actually really curious about what they do. But having said that, I was at one of Mabel's best friend's birthdays on the weekend, and I just realized I don't know what the rest of the mums at daycare actually do.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That is interesting, because I had the same, like Levi's kinder friend's mums. I mean, I know one is a psychologist because she talks about it, but the rest of them, I don't know what they actually do. And, yeah, so I guess it's because your focus is on the kids or on being a parent or on being tired.
Yeah, true, being tired, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, we all have an evil bitch in our heads telling us a bunch of untruths about ourselves.
That's like a whole gang.
Yeah. what's the main bitch saying?
That you're not good enough, or that you don't know what you're doing. Like that you're not good enough, you're not smart enough. When you go to a workshop, you won't give enough of what people want. Yeah, and she'll fixate on the one thing that was wrong. So, like, I ran a workshop recently, got all this feedback, and 9 out of 10 people said 10 out of 10, amazing, brilliant. And one person put 7 out of 10, and I was like, 7 out of 10. And that's what she'll focus on. Oh, they thought it was shit, and go in this shame spiral. But, yeah, usually that not good enough, which I guess is everyone's, which is so awful because we all think everyone else is brilliant. So
yeah, I know.
It's like a catch-22.
Yeah, it sure is. What does failure mean to you, and how has it shown up?
Goodness me. I think failure has been like saying yes to that job. So failure to put the values, the things that I value, which is, you know, my family, spirituality and health, totally failed to put them first and put this job first. I guess for me also, like, we've been trying to have a baby, another baby, and that's not been working. I do feel like a failure in that respect, because getting pregnant the first time was so easy. We were pregnant really quickly. We got pregnant again and I had a miscarriage. We had a miscarriage, I guess, last year, and then trying again and it's just not happening. And you start thinking, you know, something's wrong with me. Like, I'm a failure. Why can't I get my body to work? And those sorts of things. So I guess at the moment that seems to be the biggest failure in my life. But, you know, these are things I'm all learning, that you can't control everything, and that you can't control people dying, you can't control getting pregnant. They're two of the biggest things in your life, in a woman's life, or anyone's life, really, if you want children. And relinquish that control is very hard, because you even think, you know, I won't want it. You know, I'm happy with one. But you're kind of saying that so that the universe is like, okay, she said she's happy with one, now I'll give her two.
Yeah, yeah. I know. That's, yes. That's, I was speaking to, who was it? It might have been on, I did an interview with Samantha Nolan Smith for her Change the Game podcast. And we were talking about that. Like, it's like we know, as people with an interest in spirituality or personal growth or personal development or whatever you want to call it, self-awareness, we kind of have this understanding that it's the control that's the issue, right? Like, our need, our attachment to that outcome is blocking it from coming to us. So therefore what we need to do is surrender. And yeah. And so we kind of like go into this bargaining with the universe.
Yeah.
So it's like, I'm surrendering. Now you can give it to me.
Yeah, totally.
I've surrendered. Come on, where is it?
Yeah, my friend calls that magic thinking. Because I've been saying, like I was saying, you know, maybe if I just get healthy, maybe if I'm like super healthy, we'll get pregnant, or maybe if this happens, or maybe if, you know, the universe would stop giving me stressful things like my mother passing away, I'd be pregnant. And she's like, you're still trying to control it. That's magic thinking. It's thinking if this happens, this happens. Exactly what you said about surrendering.
Yeah, it's like a false sense of surrender. It's like you're going to your knees, but you're not willing to go all the way down yet.
Yeah. Like, come on, I'm crap.
Yeah, and it's when you do go, you know, because I had fake surrendered a lot through my life. I mean, I fake surrendered during the birthing process, you know, the actual physical birthing process of my daughter. But then when I actually reached the real surrender point, I was like, aha, I understood it before, but then I understood it, you know, like yeah. In a physical sense. It's like that whole, your husband's telling you again and again and again, and you're not hearing it. And then one day, bam, you just kind of hear it.
Yeah. And
yeah. But it's still really hard to recreate that experience without actually full surrender, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really hard. Or when we think, you know, well, we just stop trying. But then it's like, will you ever stop trying if you roughly know, you know, when you could get pregnant each month? Like, and
there's a part of it that needs to be active in it, but then also not necessarily, like, it's not like you just go, well, it kind of is like you just go, oh, well. But, yeah, I don't know. I think it's the energy in which you let the letting of the go happens.
Yeah, and the intention.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because if the intention of the letting go is to have the thing, yeah, then you haven't really let go.
No. Totally. That's what I guess.
Yeah. So, next question is, what does success mean to you?
I think success would be just to appreciate what I have, and also like to just be in the moment. Like, since my mum's passed away, it's really, it shocked me, and it's brought everything to a, you know, I'm looking at everything with a totally different lens. And you do just start appreciating being in the moment. But I think for a long time I've chased, you know, okay, I've written for this magazine, now I have to write for that magazine, now I have to become the editor, now I have to ghostwrite for this celebrity, now I'm going to work in marketing, but now I've got to be the head of marketing. I've always chased the next thing, instead of just sitting with where I'm at and being okay with that. And I think that is success, to just be okay with where you're at, not chasing all the time, like chase, because you get so exhausted. And also every time you're chasing, you're not that great at the next thing that you do for a while. So it's nice to just sit and be like, I'm pretty good at everything I'm doing right now. I don't have to chase the next big thing.
Yeah, and I think chasing, it means that whatever you're after is kind of outrunning you too. So you're constantly chasing something that is constantly out of reach, when what I've discovered is we usually have exactly what we want. We're just not seeing it for what it is.
Yeah, completely. Yeah, and I think also success would be to get to the end of your life and feel like you've helped people. Again, with my mum, the amount of stuff that came up when she passed away from her friends, from people we didn't even know, coming up and bawling their eyes and being like, she told me to go back to uni when I was 50, or she did this. Or I think when you're so fixated on yourself, sometimes you're not having the energy to help other people. I think if you can get to the end of your life and feel like, I actually made a difference, without sounding all Beyonce, I was here, anthem, that was success. That's a successful life, because you can't take anything with you, you know. When you're gone, you're gone. So all you can do is leave behind good people.
True. Freedom. What does freedom mean?
Freedom is, I guess, going back to that like mean bitch in my head, just having less of that, having like the freedom to do something and do it with confidence and not be worried about what has or hasn't happened yet. I think that would feel very free. I say I think because I don't often have that. I go to things often with a head full of worry. So that's something I'm trying to work on. So I think to me that would be complete freedom. Like if I was invited to do a speaking gig, or which I do a few of them, but I freak myself out before I get on stage and then I'm not enjoying it. Slowly I've gotten a few more where I actually enjoy it, but it takes me a good 20 minutes to get over this like goings on in my head. So I think freedom would be to just step into something with complete confidence and just stepping in for the great good of the experience, as opposed to I'm going to look like an idiot.
Yeah, I am doing speaker training next weekend, actually. It will be this weekend when the podcast comes out, in Brizzy, because I really, like, I love being on the stage, but the same as you, like the first, it takes me the first 10 to 15 minutes to warm up. Mm-hmm. and then I get into the flow, and I, you know, and I've had moments where covered in goosebumps, really feeling very cool on there once I'm present in it. Mm-hmm. But the lead up is all the anxiety and all the forward projection and all the, you know, all that kind of stuff that stops me from really enjoying it. So it's like it's okay if my talk is 50 minutes, then it'll be great. If it's 20 minutes, we're fucked.
totally. But yeah, that's it. And I think everyone's got that. You've just got to reduce it a little bit.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it helps you to be a bit anxious to, you know, get your juices flowing, but just for a few minutes.
Not giving it the power. I'm running a mastermind at the moment, and at the first retreat that we ran, somebody had mentioned that Paul McCartney still has nerves, you know. Yeah. So when he goes out on stage, he still feels anxious. And, you know, and I think that also comes down to the control thing too, right?
Yeah.
Because we don't know what's going to happen up there.
No,
and
you don't know what.
That's scary. The unknown is scary.
Yeah. But then you come off and you feel brilliant and you feel excited and you've got all these endorphins going crazy. But you kind of forget that for a minute.
Yeah. And I think for me, the speaking thing, you know, when you come off stage and you do have those people who come up to you and say how it impacted them, that's the magic in it, isn't it? Like you were just saying about leaving people, I guess, better than you found them.
Yeah.
So it's worth the nerves if you can have some impact.
Yeah, completely.
The plug. Instead of filling the podcast with self-promotion, we're being totally transparent. Here's the plug.
So I work with small creative businesses on marketing strategy, content strategy, and overall business strategy. I also do one-to-one coaching with clients. And you can find me mainly on Instagram at My Daily Business Coach. You can go to mydailybusinesscoach.com, sign up to the weekly email where I give free advice on insights and interviews with business owners. And another thing which I kind of wanted to talk about, which is not related to what I do as a career, but after Mum died, I felt the most comfort, I guess, from people who'd been through that. So I've started a little website called whenyourmotherdies.com, and it provides podcasts, books, and letters from other women. And, well, it's all women so far, happy to have men, who've written a letter to somebody in their first month after their mum dies.
Wow,
so
that's beautiful.
Yeah, I just thought they were really comforting, and it really, it does take someone that's been there to know what you're going through. I researched so much stuff when Mum died, and I couldn't find anything like this. And I've reached out to a few people and they've all said, I'd love to write a letter. So if any of your listeners have lost their mum and they'd love to write a letter, it doesn't need to be recently, they could 20 years ago. The email is whenyourmotherdies@gmail.com, or just go to whenyourmotherdies.com and have a look.
The takeaway. Exercises or tips for positive change, sprinkled with salt and vinegar, wrapped in newspaper and handed over the counter from our special guest to you.
I think just remember, like, life is short, and be in the moment because you don't get the moment back. People, you know, your children grow up, your partners get on with their lives, your friends get on with their lives, and you don't want to miss that. I have like a, I don't even know if you, oh, you can't really see it. I have a tattoo on my finger.
Oh, yeah. It's like a circle with two lines.
Two little lines. And that kind of represents that in the circle is all events, situations and experiences, and the two lines are the two paths. So you can either go down one path that aligns with your values and where you want to be at the end of your life, or you can choose the other path. So it's just about being in the moment, and once you're in the moment, you can have a bit more of a positive life.
Yeah, that is so, oh my God, that is so funny because different but similar. I still haven't had it done, but I had this idea to create two words on my arms, which was choose and create. And I was going to get them done as the waveform of my voice because, you know.
What you do.
Yeah. And so it would be like the waveform of me saying choose on one arm and the waveform of me saying create on the other, which is similar to what yours is. You can choose. You know, we always have choice, even if it's not a choice that we want to make or that we're unwilling to make, it's still choice. Yeah. And from that choice, we get to create, right? What we want, or what we don't want.
And it is, and it's a choice. And I guess that's what you don't know when you're in a bubble that you, like at work or in a relationship that's bad for you or anything, you don't remember that you have a choice. I guess that's the takeaway.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much.
Oh, no, thank you. Thanks so much, Carly, and for everything you do. It's great.
Thanks for tuning into Carlosophies. If you really dug this app, I'd love for you to share it with someone who you think might also dig it. Really helps me to spread the word. And if you'd like to get to know me a little better and see some in-between app thoughts and insights and be around some super cool people, join my Facebook tribe, Show Up Speak Up. Search Show Up Speak Up in Facebook or head to carlynimmo.com/tribe. Until next time, be real, be rad. Peace out.